You've stopped in at the Guidepost, brought to you by the American Saltwater Guides Association. Stock up on gear, grab a coffee at the counter, and get ready to hear incredible fish stories from the best captains on the East Coast and thought-provoking conversations with stakeholders and policymakers working to protect these fisheries. This podcast is presented by Costa Sunglasses.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Guidepost again. Tony here. I have a star-studded lineup. Hopefully, y'all just finished listening to kind of like our State of the Striper Fishery podcast and what stripers eat and what's wrong with stripers and what people are seeing. You know, had some great guests on that, and we're going to turn it around tonight, and we're going to do one on redfish. So I got Scotty from Charleston, Ty, Bailey from Louisiana, and we brought Blaine back to talk about the northern stock of redfish in Virginia. Thank all y'all for listening, and we're going to hop right into it. So Blaine was on the podcast last night. The rest of y'all weren't. But one of the big focuses was how difficult some of the Menhaden advocates are making it for us to conserve predatory species. In the Atlantic, it's striped bass and redfish. And in Louisiana, it's redfish. I mean, how many times, and, you know, just whoever wants to answer, how many times have y'all heard collectively, well, it doesn't matter what regulations we put on redfish, they're never going to come back unless we stop the Menhaden fishery. Do you believe that statement?
No.
Yeah, I mean,
Blaine jumps right in.
I think that's the biggest disservice to what goes on in Louisiana conservation and fisheries policy is just the straw manning of the Menhaden deal and how we can excuse all the bad behavior that we've, you know, been doing for my entire lifetime, Ty's entire lifetime, our father's entire lifetimes, and just on and on. I mean, it's an excuse, and we've just watched the fishery continue to fall down a slippery slope while we blame something that we can't really get a lot of legislation done on.
Yeah, I mean, it's mostly just, you look at it, it's always people pointing the finger at everything else, you know? It's always, it's rarely, it's, oh yeah, it's us, but also that it's always, you know, well, what about these guys? What about what these guys are doing? What about what these guys are killing and thing? And it's just one of those things where 400,000 fishing licenses, you know? I always say, long before we ever even got this whole thing started with changing limits and all years ago, I said, if all 400,000 fishing licenses just, you know, threw back one redfish a year, makes a big difference. And there's a lot of factors against it, from land loss to, you know, pretty much everything. But one thing we could do, as Tony has always said, this is the knob we have to turn. It's a pretty big knob, if you ask me. Stop killing so many damn fish.
So, Scotty, you're in a little bit of a different situation because your state actually did the right thing.
Yeah.
So what do you hear? I don't know if you hear that Menhaden are the main cause for the decline in redfish in Charleston, or do you?
There's little back chatter about it. We obviously don't ever see the commercial Menhaden boats like some of you guys do. But I've definitely heard people saying that they have seen less Menhaden this year and last year. They've seen less and less. They can't find them, things like that. But there's still plenty. They eventually find them. And I agree. I don't think that's the problem, especially with redfish, because they'll eat anything. I mean, we found them with those diamondback terrapins hanging out of their mouth, you know, trying to eat turtles, and they'll find another food source. It's not like they strictly rely on this. So yeah, I 100% agree. I think it's kicking the problem somewhere else. So, you know, doesn't make a lot of sense.
So yeah, Scotty says, you know, from his perspective, it's kicking the problem somewhere else. And I agree with that. but I also think it goes to the next layer and it's a little more nefarious. And it's not only is it like kicking the problem to something else, but it's directing advocacy to an area that's probably easier to raise money for. Now, how do you, I see a lot of head shaking.
Yeah. There's, I mean, that's what, that's, you know, it's definitely been something that, you know, has been an easy bandwagon to jump on. And then obviously down here in Louisiana, everybody knows the opposition we stand against the Menhaden fleet. So it's kind of one of those things like, man, if we just keep on this fight and keep saying all these things that get pushed back and shot down every legislative session, we could keep the money coming in. The fishing, you know, redfish, the problem never gets better. And we have money just sitting in our pockets in perpetuity. It's kind of like, yeah, I've always said, the cancer and the cure.
Yeah, without a problem, with these guys don't have a job. They're creating artificial problems. Yeah.
Like I was saying, Tony, you know, to me, it kind of goes towards that, like, burning political capital thing, too. I mean, when we're spending all this time throwing bills on the desk of the governor, bills in the Senate, bills in the House about Menhaden, regulation and these little, just like, you know, I mean, the podcast we did about all the Menhaden bills that we saw come through the state legislature down here, it just, it drowns out the voice of real meaningful change that can occur in the fishery too. So not only is it like a funding thing and a money thing, but, you know, these, we've heard it in the commission at LDWF, you know, we don't want to hear anything else about the Menhaden thing. So every time we go up there talking about this and everybody gets all activated and yelling about this, knowing that the end result is going to be, you know, a pretty, you know, nothing's really going to happen. We just continue to kind of use up our political capital and our ability to get the ear of these guys that are in positions to make decisions.
Let's talk about the decline of redfish, and we're going to start with Louisiana. So back when that stock assessment came out years ago, it showed that y'all were at an all-time low for redfish over 10 years old since the mid-80s. And if you had gone to three fish and not killed a big fish, you would have had a rebuilding timeline of 16 years, which is staggeringly long. But they went to four fish instead because, you know, that's just too much to bear. And y'all put yourself on a timeline somewhere between 35 and 40 years. It was like 37, 38 years. And then y'all had a cold event where I saw y'all were sending me pictures of you running around in 12 inches of snow, which I have never seen in my lifetime. In Louisiana or south of Louisiana or south of New Orleans. Never. I mean, I think northern Louisiana can get a couple inches of snow every once in a while.
I don't think anybody alive has seen that much snow south of New Orleans.
So y'all had a biblical level fish kill. I mean, we saw all the pictures. We saw the videos. There were guys wading around and the bottom of the ocean was covered in dead fish. And the funny thing is we never really heard the results of that. I never saw a report on that cold stun. So you guys kind of got the 1-2 punch of you're at an all-time low of big fish. You didn't get the reduction that you needed. And then Mother Nature kicked you in the hoo-ahs. So what, y'all are both guides. What's the red fishing like now?
Well, I always,
right now in Louisiana.
I've said this a few times, and I think it's just funny to me when I think about what I used to tell clients they needed to be able to do to catch fish here. Used to be when I'd get a call with like a first-time angler that was like, well, you know, what's kind of the situations like? I'd say, you know, if you can make a 30-foot cast with reasonable accuracy, you're going to catch some fish. We're going to get a good amount of shots at big redfish. You're probably going to catch a big redfish while you're here, et cetera, et cetera. Nowadays, I mean, where I fish particularly. I really fish in the Hopedale area. You have to be an absolute straight up ninja to catch fish there, especially those big fish that are tailing and doing like our big resident fish that are there and see a lot of pressure. They are smart. Those fish are not anywhere near like what they used to be. You're not just going to, every once in a while you'll get those days where that happens. But by and large now, you got to be able to throw 50 plus feet. You got to be able to read that fish, understand what that fish is doing, because you're not going to get that just layup easy. You know, you can see the whole fish at 30 foot shot anymore. You're going to get a lot of these like fishes tailing out at 60 feet. By the time you get about 40 feet from him, he's starting to kind of pop off that edge and just kind of saunter his way down to deeper water. So, I mean, for me, what we see in my fishery is just way more difficult big redfish fishing, way more technical. And I actually think, you know, I could go into a whole long discussion about how that's hurt Louisiana in more ways than one, because there was such a vein of marketing at Louisiana being the easy saltwater fishery, the beginner saltwater fly fishery, and these things like, just go down there, you're going to catch big fish, you're going to pull on fish. And it's not like that anymore in Hopedale. I tell my clients now, if you catch one of these 25-plus pound fish, feather to put in your cap. If you catch a big tailing fish on an edge out there, that's really something to feel accomplished about. And it's gotten a lot more difficult.
Yeah, I mean, we've definitely seen, and that's kind of what we saw with every scenario that we were given as far as what the limits could have been, you know, whether it was three fish 18 to 24, three fish, whatever, two fish 18 to 27. We knew our spawning, you know, our spawning stock was going to decline for some years until it comes back up. One thing that I've seen, you know, what's funny is, you know, we've seen more little ones the past couple of years than we had in that. I think 21 through 23 is the worst, you know, 21 through 2023 is the worst all around red fishing I've ever seen in my life down here. Mainly because we had so few little ones, especially because that's, I mean, the just slot fish and all. I mean, I feel like I focus more on slot fish than just about anything throughout the year. And, you know, that's the springtime, summertime, the spin fish, no matter what it is. But, you know, we changed the limit just a little bit, you know, had some decent weather for a decent spawn. And we've definitely got some little ones back. And it's pretty funny that some of these guys that fought me tooth and nail about the whole limit stuff, they're like, oh, yeah, we haven't seen, it's so crazy. We haven't seen this, you know, these little ones in some years. I'm like, yeah, it's amazing. We killed one less fish. Imagine how good it would be. We did three fish, you know, how much more of those little ones we would see. Now, I definitely think it's affected our spawning stock because, like Bailey said, I feel like we just don't see as many of those throughout the area in general. And they definitely are more pressured, especially like when they get in schools, you know, there's feel like there's less schools and less big schools than there used to be. And people beat them up pretty good. And those fish are old. They've seen a lot. They get smart. But I mean, it's definitely as a whole, we kind of, I don't know, almost put ourselves in purgatory. I think that freeze turned out to be, I mean, based on what the data showed on it, not long after they kind of put it in that 2018 freeze category. I don't know if y'all remember it when we had that freeze in 2018, Bailey, but I think, you know, like at least where I was in Port Sulphur, I mean, it was pretty much unfishable from February till May last year after that freeze, just because it was a very localized detrimental thing for, I mean, I thought it was worse than the 2018 freeze just based on what I saw. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely changed a lot. And it's kind of refreshing on the other end to see we make a small change and we see a little hope, you know? So it gets me like, man, if we could just get people behind wanting to see more fish and showing them how much a difference we make as anglers, whether it's pressure or just taking numbers of fish out the water, it's far more You know, we do far more as anglers and rod and reel anglers than any other asset of the fishery. And we can't snap our fingers and make 100,000 acres of marsh appear overnight. Maybe if we could do that, we'd have a different story, but that's not possible. So our next knob is just stop killing so many fish. And look, you know, we have definitely more slot fish than we had like that 21 through 23 time frame. Hopefully that equates to building back up that spawning stock. But I just was worried when I saw that four fish instead of three that, you know, you don't want to end up in purgatory. We had that freeze. Maybe we just barely got over it, and we luckily changed limits in time to not to have a few extra fish. And it, whether it set us back 2 years or 10, it set us back. There's no question about it. Nobody could say it did not set us back. And it wouldn't have set us back as much if we had three fish. But maybe we'll see it on the incline. But I, like I've always said, you know, people want to argue with when we were fighting back and forth with the three fish, four fish thing. I'm like, look, if I'm wrong in 5 years, we have a much better fishery. But if you're wrong in 5 years, we're kind of screwed. So I'd rather be on the more conservative end every time.
So, Ty, do you think it's gotten more difficult or stayed the same or gotten better over the years for you as of late? Like, overall?
Overall, I think with the little ones, I've seen more fish in the fall and spring as far as slot fish goes than I did 21 through 23. Now, the bull reds, I think after that freeze was pretty tough. But it's definitely, I think it's progressively gotten, you know, worse the past, I'd say 5 to 7 years for sure, with big fish. But, you know, like I always tell people, it's hard to see what the fishery really is on the best days, because if you and your guys caught 20 fish and me and my guys caught 18, you know, like, both of those guys are going to say it's awesome. Hell, if y'all caught 35 fish and my guys caught 15, both of those groups are going to say those are incredible days. So it's really hard to tell. What I notice is on the tough days, when you have those days that it's cloudy and blowing, that's when you see what the fishery actually is. You know, that's when you're like, okay, well, you know, a tough day with clouds and wind used to be we get 10 shots and catch a couple of those. Now it's you kind of grind, especially in those times where you really shouldn't have to. So,
yeah, it seems like for me, I would definitely agree with you there. A lot more weather days, a lot more like a lot easier to be affected by, you know, negative conditions for sure. I can remember grinding out so many good days and crummy conditions, and that is a lot harder to do these days. It seems like I remember one time I was talking to a guy, like this was like 6 or 7 years ago at the Sheepy, and he was like, "Man, when was the last time you saw a bull redfish picture on fly with a cloud with clouds in the background in the sky, like a cloudy sky?" And I'm like, "That's kind of a good point." And I just think about that like every year now, and I'm like, "God, yeah. It has gotten so much harder."
No, I mean you're right. It's definitely changed, and that's when I think you go anywhere in the world and, you know, go in the worst conditions, and that's how you're going to find that equilibrium, that kind of, you know, give you your basis of what the fishery is actually like.
So, Blaine, I mean, arguably, you travel the most out of anyone on this podcast. I don't think anyone's going to deny that, and you probably fish for redfish everywhere where you can catch a redfish. From Texas, you know, to Virginia.
Yep.
What are you seeing?
Well, I see the same.
Over time, over the last 15, 20 years.
Yeah, definitely. There's pockets of places that are better, but like in Scotty's area, South Carolina, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, I was fishing with Newman down there every winter. Those creeks were just loaded with really nice above slot fish to slot fish. It just absolutely stacked in those small creeks. You know,
we don't even do it anymore because he always tells me it's not even close to being worth it. So that's South Carolina. Virginia is another thing, you know, with what you helped pass with the giant fish that we have, you know, on the East Coast. I was introduced over COVID to a lot of our shallow water flats fishing here in Virginia and North Carolina and stuff because I couldn't travel as much. And I was astonished by what I saw. But over the past two winters, a lot of those shallow water slot size to slightly over slot fish are, I mean, I've got buddies. I haven't even gone this year because I got buddies that say it's not even worth it. They haven't seen a fish in the shallows, slot fish in the shallows anywhere where we always go. So, you know, there's environmental problems, obviously, but, you know, the elephant in the room is us, and we never want to blame ourselves. We want to blame everything else for, you know, global warming or whatever you want to call it, all this different stuff. They want to blame everything else except humans. And, you know, it's greed, it's whatever. The thing that drives me crazy is coming down and being a part of these hearings and whatever, even going down to Louisiana with you guys. And I mean, the opposition, which should be on, we all as collectively should be together on this stuff. And it's unbelievable how people are so afraid that if they agree to something, even though they know it's not right, like these other fit anglers and Ty and Bailey know I'm talking about, that tell us that we don't know how to catch them. There, you know, there's plenty of fish, right? So they always say that. I mean, I've seen it everywhere. And from Virginia to North Carolina, you name it, the opposition, which shouldn't be, because they know it's not what it could be or what it should be. And I've seen it in Louisiana. Been going down there 15 plus years, and it's 100% changed. I've seen it. If you could get a fly in the water down there 15, 20 years ago, you're going to get them, you know? And now it's like you got to actually have a little bit of a game to get those fish now. And then traveling to Texas, I mean, Texas is cool, but I mean, it's a stock fishery. I mean, you see so many little redfish there. It's like, where, you know, it's just weird how it's okay to stock fish. That's never solving any problems. And that to me was a big turnoff. I mean, they have beautiful coastline there, beautiful flats, but to know that they catch so many that they have to stock it so heavily, which is ridiculous. And then you've got Florida and, you know, Alabama and Mississippi's got the smaller coasts and all, and they've got good fishing, but it's, you talk to any of those guides, they see the changes, whether those fish are migrating from Louisiana over or whatever it may be, it's different. And in Florida, for sure, big time differences over the past 20 plus years down there. There's pockets of places that are pretty good, but as a whole, nothing's about it. I never hear any guide friend, any angler friend that said, man, the fishing is so much better than it was 20 years ago. Nobody says that hardly ever.
Well, and Blaine, I just want to say it's interesting to hear you talking about all your guide friends, because you do have so many guide friends that will tell you these things about how their fishery has changed for the worse. It's gotten harder. I find it such an interesting position that we're in as guides, talking about a decline in our respective fisheries. It's such a sensitive subject for all of us. And I feel like only recently have you started seeing guys kind of get up and say publicly some of this stuff, because I'm sure a lot of these guys told you this kind of thing, like, you know, in the boat or over a beer after a day of fishing. They're not getting out and saying it publicly. They're scared to talk about this stuff and really talk about, you know, there's such an interesting thing to me with, like, the goalpost moving in Louisiana, which is the fishery's gotten harder. Well, how do you handle that? Do you just sit here and say, well, Louisiana sucks now? Or do you sit here and talk about how, you know, you can go permit fishing and, you know, you're over here having a celebration if you catch one fish in a week? And so to me, with bull redfish fishing, we don't have to catch 20 bull redfish a day to have a good day. You can catch a few. You can have days where you miss your shots and it doesn't happen. And I feel like as guides, we need to do a better job of not like just not acknowledging because we're scared of what is going on in our fishery, but change the way we talk about our fishery, highlight the fact that challenging is not bad. It just means you got to bring, like you said, you got to have game to get out there. That's a more sustainable thing to me as far as a guide goes. Like, my best clients are the guys that can actually catch those challenging fish. They like that, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'll add to this, and this is, none of that was a cut on Louisiana. I mean, Louisiana is still the goal for everybody, all the other states. I mean, as good as the red fishing was here in Virginia before our two cold winters where we lost a lot of the slot fish, we had beautiful clear flats, and you would think there'd be redfish everywhere, but they were only in pockets, even when it was really good, right? And for me, not, you know, living 4 hours away, and I'd get down there for 4 or 5 days in a row, it takes me a while to figure out what, you know, the areas that they're frequenting at that time. You know, for you guys in Louisiana, it's still by far the best redfishing there is in shallow water. I mean, here on the East Coast, North Carolina, Virginia, South Carolina, we have big bull reds, big schools of big bull reds in open water. But we don't have that shallow water fishery like you guys have. I mean, there's places that are really good, but I mean, as a whole, you guys still are king. It, whether it's on a decline or not, and we know that it is, it's still world class. I don't care what anybody says. I mean, is it what it was 10, 15, 20 years ago? No, but no place is. And that's our fault. It's our fault because we kill them all. And whether they want to say it or not, it's the truth. I mean, all you got to do is look. And that's the problem. The guys that are stepping up and talking about it now, those are the beacons that all the other guys should be looking at. And instead of what we were talking about in the Striper podcast, where guides, there's a lot of conventional, and it could be fly too, I'm not going to say, but they base their whole business on dock shots instead of getting clientele that's going to be more sustainable, that want to enjoy a day on the water. If they could go out and catch 30, 40, 50 redfish in a day when it's phenomenal on live bait or whatever, right? Instead of catching 5 or 6 and getting their limit or whatever it may be in that given area, I guarantee you people are going to want to be hooked up all day long when they're paying for a charter versus a few fish and then head back to the dock, period.
And well, that's what changed so much here too, Blaine. I know you've been to Venice plenty of times and seen that. Like, yeah. You know, it's those guys who are screaming, there's no problem. When like 10, 15 years ago, did you see guys, you know, going out at the crack of dawn with live shrimp under a popping cork to go chase redfish? No. They were running, you know, out to Block 69 and Chandelier to catch trout. They didn't give a shit about a redfish. And then, you know, the bull red thing now they do because the trout fishing's not there as much. And they're still, you know, popping corks, stuff like that. It's just, and then for them to equate it to the whole limit thing too, it's like, exactly what you just said. So those guys, let's say, you know, you got two, some of those guys, you got two guys, they think it's awesome that they made 10 casts, caught 8 slot reds, and they're back at the dock at 7:15. And they're like, oh, what are you talking about? I caught my limit so fast today. It's awesome. Like, you threw a live shrimp under a cork, you know, in April, caught some 8 barely legal fish. Your clients just gave you an ungodly amount of money to make 10 casts. And you're ranting and raving about it.
I have to say something here. I'm going to jump out of my skin. Listen, and Blaine will back me up on this. There's a whole subset of the charter community here that does exactly what you just said for stripers. They brag back at, like, in trophy season when we had it. We don't have it anymore. But they would brag if they were back to the dock in 45 minutes. And I'd always just listen to them and be like, who are you taking out?
Yeah.
Like, if you're paying $1,000 and you're like, and somebody turned around to me on a boat and said, got our limit, we're going in.
Yeah, the better the fishing is, the quicker you're done.
I'd be like, you're out of your mind. Or I'm never going with you again. Like, you know, your website says this much for 5 hours, this much for 8 hours, this much. Like, it didn't say when you catch fish, we're heading for the barn so I can pick up my next group and I can double down on today and kill twice as many fish and I don't care about anything. I mean, and then these are the same guys who cannot book clients right now because the fishing's tough. And they're the ones that are going off the cliff first. And it's because their business model sucks. And Blaine, we talked about that. If your business model is packing a cooler, sell your boat.
Yeah, you're going to have a hard time.
You're not going to be in business in 5-7 years. I'm not trying to be mean. I'm giving you great business advice.
I think it's such just a care for it too. Like, you know, we've all heard it, if, you know, about getting people into fishing. If you love something, you'll take care of it. And I look at that, you don't love it, clearly. You're not taking care of it. And if you're doing this and you're just looking for a guaranteed paycheck, go work at a plant. Go do anything else because it'll make you way more money. And then you fish for fun. You're not fishing for fun. I look at what we get to do guiding. Yes, it's a job, but also like it's a privilege that I get to call this my job, in my opinion. I'm like, I feel privileged that I get to fish and go watch a redfish eat. And, you know, maybe I'll throw that fish back and somebody else catch it. Maybe we take one home for dinner every now and then. But it's just like, I think it's those people that they don't care about it. They look at it as an easy, quick paycheck, and they never have return clients. They're just hammering their internet ads. And going back to the whole dock shot thing, I always tell all my clients and everybody that asks me, have you ever seen a picture of a dock shot out above somebody's mantle when you go over by their house? Never. You will never, ever see that. But how many people, you know, that... You know, Bailey, I'm sure you've had it. I mean, Blaine, how many, like, you know, pictures of people holding a big fish or a slot fish? Yeah, exactly. Like, what are they putting on a Christmas card? Not their 8, you know, or 12 fish limit that was taken on the dock and posted on the Facebook page later that day, you know?
Well, I want to just say kind of something you said there, Ty, that kind of made me remind myself of some conversations that I had with some conventional guides at one of the commission meetings that we did have about regulation changes. It is interesting to hear the different reasons for kind of this not acknowledging of the decline and kind of just like moving these goalposts in quietly. And I do think, you know, all these things you're saying, I think you're right on about, but I also think there is an element. You know, I've been a guide now pretty much my entire adult life. Okay. I've been in fisheries. I dropped out of college and I pursued being a guide. And I look at my life now, I'm 33, and I don't know what I would do if I was not in the guiding, the fishing, traveling, you know, owning my lodge now. But like I'm in the fishing world entirely. And if I had to just pack up and leave because my fishery went to shit or I lost all my business, I don't know what I would do. It would be pretty scary. So I do think some of these guides, like there's an element of fear that motivates them. Like it's a business thing. They're scared if they start talking about, I'll just never forget one of these guys. I had four conventional guys that opposed us on the redfish regulation change. And they were all kind of ganging up on me in the parking lot. But we got into an actually good conversation. And one of them was like, yeah, you know, I'm not going to say this on the podium or I'm not going to say this publicly, but we sure do burn a lot more gas than we used to getting to those fish. And I'm like, there you go. Like, they all know it. They all see it. Some of them, you know, there's all these reasons. But I do think, like, I actually would say that us as ASGA getting out and talking about this and showing that you can conduct a successful business while talking about how your fishery's in trouble. If any of these guides are paying attention, maybe it shines a little light on the fact that we can acknowledge issues in our fisheries, and we're not just going to tank our business and pack up and we're done. And I think that's really important because a lot of these old-timey guides, I think that's an issue. I think they really don't see a way to change the way that they've marketed their business for years, especially here in Louisiana. Kill all the fish you can, get in by noon, good day. And that's not sustainable. And where we are now, they get flack for that by people like us. And so it's interesting to see, like, I think some of these guys, you know, if they open their eyes and they look at what's going on around them, you don't have to be that way anymore. And you can still have a successful business as a guide or an outfitter.
So, Scotty, you know, South Carolina is an anomaly because not only were we able to work with South Carolina DNR and the South Carolina legislature to get these regulation changes through, but we also saw the testimony be so lopsided that it was unbelievable. And I think it's because South Carolina is, you know, is just known for sight fishing for redfish. That's South Carolina's deal. So, you know, I guess the story here is that the guides in South Carolina can make a living while not filling the cooler. So, like, how did that, because you, I mean, you owned a fly shop in Charleston. You've been part of this community forever. When did you see it change, or, you know, how did it happen? Because I think the rest of us would love to know, because it's not the world we live in.
Right. I think Ty nailed it. I think the privilege of being a fishing guide is being able to share the passion, not how many fish you can spike through a nail on the dock. And again, like you said, there, you'll never see a picture hanging over the mantle like that. And I think that's kind of always been the mentality here. I think we knew we had something special. Even when I started fishing here, it was probably about 1990. And it was good, but there was never really that kill 'em all mentality here. And I'm not sure the disconnect with the Gulf. I will say I was privileged to fish Louisiana a good bit. And the worst part about my guiding career was when people would show up, I'd say, "Hey, have you ever redfish before?" And like, "Yeah, Louisiana." So I'd be like, "All right, look, this is, you're not going to catch 50 fish. You know, we might get 10 shots, you know." I just don't think we had that massive number of fish to have it in our heads that we could exploit this fishery and kill that many. But I think he nailed it. You know, that was, and I think that's kind of been the overall mentality here. I know I have a few good friends that'll kill as many fish as you, though they're allowed to kill. They have commercial permits, yet they're fishing guides too, so they can keep more. But overall, I think just the mentality here is we're here to protect this resource. And I don't want to say it's always been that way because I've only been here 30 years or so, but the others, there's a good DNR. They've always put out publications. Like even in the mid 90s, when I was in college, I remember them putting out sea trout studies saying, "Hey, if you keep a 12 inch fish, they're going to produce 200,000 eggs. If you keep a 15 inch or release a 15 inch fish, that's 2 million eggs." So I think our DNR has just been really proactive in educating the public. And I think it's shown because the majority of people here have a conservative mindset.
Well, it's wild because, you know, the further south you go, arguably the more productive and the water is and the more life, you know, the variety of species, whatever. And there's so many things that people can bring home that I don't think anyone would have a problem with. I mean, I was going over the Georgia regulations because that final comment period was a couple of days ago. It ended on the 30th. And we figured it out. So if you're truly fishing to feed yourself, there's no slight in that. If you're truly fishing to feed yourself and you're sticking to the regulations in Georgia, you can keep 15 sheep's head, 15 trout, 15 flounder, 5 redfish, 25 ling, So sea mullet, whatever you want to call them, kingfish. Some people call them kingfish. 25 croaker and 25 spot. So I didn't just do this in my head, but that's 155 fish.
Yeah, you're a fat son. One recreational,
I actually had to add it up and I just remember it. It's 155 fish that you can keep. And if they change the redfish regulations, now you can keep 153 to three fish. So I kind of think that, and these are, and I picked fish that are readily available from a shore or pier or like a little 10 boat. I didn't pick fish that you need an expensive boat to go out and catch. I'm talking about subsistence fishing. So, and in Louisiana in particular, there's like no limit on sheep's head. You can keep as many as you want. So I can't even apply that 150. And we've all seen the pictures when the sheep's head spawn. Some people do keep 155 sheep's head. Like we've seen the totes full of them. So to me, it doesn't come down to, you know, it's not even worth buying a license if we can't keep these fish, because there's a million other fish you can eat. I don't know. I mean, from that kind of culture, we're not saying you can't kill a redfish. We're not saying you can't kill other fish. But what we are saying is occasionally you have to be a good steward of the resource and you have to not be selfish and you have to take a hit for a little while. So hopefully your kids and your grandkids can catch these fish. Future generations, right? That's what it's all about. So that's kind of like my two cents on it. I appreciate you sharing the South Carolina tidbit because, again, Scotty, it's an anomaly. You know, at that ASMFC meeting, there was a lot of boat trading going on. And you're, as a state, you're always allowed to be more conservative. So if they come out 10 years from now and say you can kill two stripers, a state could stand up and say that's too much. We're going to kill one. You can always be more conservative. And the way it played out, South Carolina was more conservative than they had to be. They wanted to bring this fishery back as quickly as possible. And that's amazing. That doesn't happen every day. Unfortunately, we didn't see the same thing in Virginia. North Carolina held really strong. They did the right thing. And obviously, you know, the problems that we see in Louisiana. So, you know, a lot of the claims that are going on right now that make conservation really hard, specifically in Virginia and Louisiana with redfish, is that it doesn't matter what we do, they'll never come back as long as that omega fishery's there. And that upsets me to no end because it's not true. And we're going to play a little game, right? I know y'all have kept redfish and y'all have been able to keep big redfish if you wanted to up until a few years ago. Like, y'all, Bailey and Ty fish in totally different places, totally different, you know, situations. Blaine fishes in a different situation. Scotty fishes in a very different situation. You know, king tides, flooded grass. How important do you think menhaden are to your respective diets for redfish? I mean, I'm serious question. You may say, Tony, it's the most important thing where I'm from. But with all the different ways that y'all fish, everything that you've seen these damn things eat, you know, we had a very long conversation about striped bass on this. And we're not saying by any stretch of the imagination that the menhaden fishery doesn't need to be more regulated or that it's not important to the whole ecosystem, not just redfish or stripers. But in all honesty, with all the variety that y'all have, how important do you think menhaden are to redfish in your respective areas?
I mean, you go, Blaine.
Well, I have a different perspective, obviously, because I travel so much. And you know, being in Virginia, my home waters, it's a little different here because, one, I've experienced the super shallow flats, clear water, grass flats. 100% those fish aren't eating menhaden there. But as those fish progress and get bigger and bigger, when they move out into open water, menhaden become a big part of their diets, as well as crabs. But, you know, the striper fishery that we used to have that we don't have anymore, you know, they claim that the stripers are struggling because of menhaden. That's not true. If any fish in the bay would struggle from menhaden depletion, it would be the big bulls and the cobia, because that's what we have during the summer months here now, because we have pockets of stripers, but it's not much. And then, you know, I have family in South Carolina, so I get to go every year and fish with Newman in his part of the world, and we'll be chasing different fish species, and we'll go out along the beaches, and there's acres and acres of bunker there, you know, small bunker, peanut bunker, and up to about 5-6 inches. So, but do we ever see a redfish on any of those? No, I haven't with them, and I fish with them a lot. Do they get on those at times? Yes, they do. Just like we talked about the other day with stripers. In my opinion, redfish will eat whatever's readily available. I've seen redfish eating just about everything. But there's something really interesting at ribbonfish. I've seen big schools of those big bulls eating ribbonfish out, you know, which is wild. It's amazing to see that. So, you know, if you get an acre or more of a school of redfish and they encounter any type of bait or any food source, they're going to garbage it, right? So it depends on where those fish are in their life cycle, on how they feed on different critters, you know, whether it's crabs or shrimps or different types of baits. And then moving into Florida, you know, the shallow water stuff, most of the time, when I say shallow water, I'm talking about poling type of water, they're not eating that kind of food. That's generally open for open water fish, or like for you guys, when you're fishing near the Gulf, you know, where they can slide out into a little bit deeper water and then slide back into the shallows, you're going to find them, and I'm sure you guys can correct me, but you're going to find days where they are on schools of bunker. And I've seen that with Ty before. So there's times where that happens, but is that their main food source in those given areas? I don't believe it is. I think there's a lot of different foods out there available to them. And I fish Texas all the way up to Maryland and caught redfish in every state. And I've seen all the different ways these fish feed and their different communities and all that kind of stuff all over our country. And to say that menhaden is the main reason that redfish are in trouble, just like saying menhaden's a big problem for striped bass, that's just not true. Would it benefit them to have more of those available to them? 100%. But the lack of the predators, the prey items obviously are on the decline like the predators are, but it's connected, but not connected in this situation, in my opinion.
I think you're spot on too, Blaine, but with it, like, I think it's more, you know, we deal with the pogies a lot down here, especially on the west side of the river in the fall and like out in the sound in the summer and all that stuff. Now, I definitely do think it's, you know, it's something that redfish do fall, especially the big ones when the big pogies show up. But we also find some slot fish chasing some of the small schools, like the little bitty baby pogies in the spring and all too. But I think the argument more, and the best way I could put this too, at least for people down here, because everybody duck hunts down here too, is I look at it like this. You know, is menhaden important to redfish? Yes, it is. But if we got rid of menhaden fishing tomorrow, will that fix it? No. if we stop killing so many fish, that's, you know, the tiers far above that. It's, I kind of put it in the duck hunting terms. Is the flooded corn stuff north of us an issue? Yes, to an extent. Is the habitat an issue? Yes. Is the temperature an issue? Yes. Is the breeding grounds of the ducks an issue? It all affects us. But, you know, I look at the things that we can control. And, you know, Tony's always been good about reminding me that, like, try to manage what you can control. And the number one thing we can manage, like I said, we can't make land appear overnight. We're definitely not in Louisiana under this, you know, administration are touching the Menhaden fleet for a while. So I look at the things we can control. We could kill less fish. It tremendously helps. You know, we've seen the ebb and flow throughout our fishery. If you were to match it up with the Menhaden catches, I guarantee you it would not run hand in hand. It would go back and forth. Just as I was telling y'all earlier, I think 21 through 23 was far worse than the past 2 years. Absolutely. Now, if you go ran the numbers on Menhaden catches, did they just so happen to catch way more Menhaden those couple years and take way more away, and that's why the red fishing was worse? No, it's because we killed them faster than they could reproduce for 11 to 12 years. And then we were kind of scraping the bottom of the barrel. We put some regulations through, and then all of a sudden, 2 years later, we got a ton of 2 to 3 year old fish. You know, I'll say a ton, a lot more than we had 21 through 23, which is basically zero. So I think if you look at it from that standpoint, it's kind of an eye-opening thing. But it is an easy thing to raise money for. It is something that you kind of just can scream and yell about and say, oh, look, this is what we're doing. And, you know, I look at it like the stocking thing. You scream and yell and say, hey, we'll put more fish in the water. It doesn't do anything. But, you know, you just keep giving us the money. We'll keep putting more fish in. And you have a money stream in perpetuity.
So because y'all all fish, generally y'all fish a ton of shallow water. I know sometimes you'll move out to deeper water. But Scotty, so we're going to go Scotty, Bailey, Ty. Just go talk about what redfish eat. You know, Blaine went through the whole country, but the fact that menhaden are critically important to those enormous schools of giant redfish, along with other things. I mean, they're monsters, dinosaurs that will eat anything. But Scotty, like, I'm going to guess, you know, because I had family in Charleston. Man, fiddler crabs hard to beat in Charleston, man. Like, you know, right? I mean, they're just eating all the little creatures, shrimps, crabs, right?
That's what they're doing. They're waiting on that high tide. They get up there when it raises 6 feet from low, and those fiddler crabs become accessible. Juvenile blue crabs, they'll fight a full grown blue crab, but I think crustaceans are the majority of their diet. They do eat a lot of shrimp. They're very opportunistic. They'll eat a mullet if they can catch it, but they're not going to chase it down. You know, that's why crabs are so perfect. And I do think menhaden is important to that. You know, if we have a bad menhaden year, the crab fishermen always seem to complain that they're having a pretty bad crabbing year too. So I do think that's connected, but not directly. Our redfish are crab eaters for the most part until they reach that breeding age and they leave the inshore estuaries and go offshore. It's a vast majority of crabs. That's what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think my perspective from it is from someone that fishes pretty much in one area of Louisiana in two different, very different boats. I have a small skiff and a big bay boat, and so I follow those big schools of redfish out all the way, you know, 30 plus miles offshore. And then I'm also way back in the places where we can catch a largemouth bass and a redfish on the same cast. And, you know, kind of what Blaine was saying, really just you can put that whole summary in our one little fishery in Louisiana, being the Delacroix, Hopedale, Reggio kind of triangle in there. Like Biloxi Marsh and all that, you know, those smaller fish that are more interior, obviously, you know, they're not really eating a lot of menhaden way back up in that stuff. You're not seeing those big schools of menhaden. When we go out and we're chasing them on the big boat in the big boats. You're around the menhaden boats throughout the day. They're on the menhaden some. A big open water pattern that we're on that Blaine mentioned was the floating crabs. When you get those big floating blue crabs, that's like the bite. And I will stay on a bite like that for weeks at a time. Those redfish will not even move sometimes. And even if you're not seeing those crabs, you can float a crab pattern out there and they will come up and just smash that thing. I can't tell you how many times I've seen just a random crab and I've stopped my boat, circled back, and it's like triple tail on a crab buoy. You know, there's like four redfish just watching the crab, you know, for whatever reason. They're not eating it, but they're just floating underneath it, looking at it, big bulls. And, you know, there's a pile of them down in like 6, 8, 10 feet of water, but every once in a while they'll float up. So, and then the ribbonfish thing too. I mean, they just smash ribbonfish around us. So the menhaden thing definitely comes and goes. At times they're on the menhaden big time, but then, you know, they get on big wads of shrimp. They get on ribbonfish. I've got them at those big rafts of floating mullet, and they'll be up in amongst the mullet, doing that kind of deal. We just have such a varied ecosystem when it comes to bait that even those offshore fish, there's a lot of different stuff that they run into. But it is interesting, just in one fishery in just my area. I don't trailer around a lot. You know, menhaden's only just a component of the diet for sure.
It's yeah, and I think that's what I'm hearing from everyone, is not discounting that they're important or and loaded with fat in a great meal for a big redfish. You know, I think a striper has to be about 27, and I would imagine it's the same thing for redfish, about 27, 28 inches to eat an adult menhaden. You know, they're not even going to go after it. It's an adult menhaden, not a peanut. So Ty, you know, you're in Pontchartrain. Would you echo everything that Scotty Bailey and Blaine has said about menhaden? Is it a little different there? What do you?
I mean, around here, it's a lot more like localized fishery for sure. I mean, we'll get pogies later in the summer and they'll definitely eat those. But I mean, especially around like the lake and all, I mean, they focus a lot on mullet. And it is far different fishery too. It's more resident fish around here than anything, and then slot fish. And obviously, I mean, as far as if we're just ranking, you know, favorite foods of redfish and slot fish and all, I mean, slot fish in Louisiana it's shrimp. It's shrimp 99.9% of the year for the little ones that they're chasing pretty much in every single part of Louisiana. You know, like I mentioned, like I'll see the little baby pogies kind of in the marsh in April usually for a couple weeks, and then they'll eat those. I mean, they'll eat whatever's around. They like those, but like take those out and they're not, you know, it's not, I mean, obviously menhaden are very important to us, but it's not like we're talking about, you know, get rid of the menhaden fishing and just overnight better. And what I see of a lot of those same guys that are saying, oh, if we just get rid of these damn boats, red fishing will be so good. They're not saying because of the menhaden that are coming out of the water. They're saying because they're just killing the redfish. And I'm like, hold on here. That's the argument we don't want to hear. You know, if you're just arguing on killing redfish, then, you know, we're right back to 400,000 fishing licenses and what that turns into killing redfish wise. So I think y'all are spot on with all that for sure. And it's definitely something that you don't want to really see people who care kind of go down the rabbit hole of like, oh, well, that sounds about right. Maybe I'll see what they're talking about and just go along with it, you know, because that's, we all were kind of in that boat of, what do we do? Who do we follow at one point?
It's real easy to get really upset when you see these rafts of dead redfish and these big fish kills. And it's preying on, you know, kind of the social media age. It's perfect for that. You post a little 10-second clip of a million dead redfish on the beach and everybody can get mad about that, from a guy that wants to kill them because that's seen as waste to him, to people like us who never want to kill a bull redfish again. And, you know, everybody gets upset about that. And it's really easy to tap into people's emotions and get some response online with those kind of things. And I think that's the bycatch thing in Louisiana. That's the problem. It's that emotional, visceral reaction to the 10-second clip, and that's all people see, and that's where the information flow stops for them because they see that and they're outraged.
You know, so, you know, like Blaine said, it's not like it's the end for Louisiana, or, and I think South Carolina's got an incredibly bright future. And you know, this podcast, I hope what people get out of it, as I have, you know, what I would easily call a expert panel on these fish. I hope what people get out of it is that this advocacy stuff is not cut and dry. And I wish it was easier. My life would be a lot easier if it was easier. But you have to, there's no demon in this, right? Like there isn't a boogeyman where you can just point your finger and say, it's all their fault. Right. And that's what they're doing. It's the easiest thing to do with the reduction fishery, and they need to be managed better. I mean, geez, Louise, you want to talk about being managed better? Like there's no management essentially in Louisiana, and we're fixing to start, you know, another World War III Part 20 here in August and November with Addendum 2 for Menhaden on the East Coast. So I'm going to give my advice. I'd like to hear y'all's advice, but my advice is simple. If you really care about this stuff, don't look at that 10-second video clip and make your mind up. Actually dig in and I mean, geez, it's so easy with AI. These days, ask AI to scan a whole bunch of different websites and give you an update on what the problem is, and you'll be like 70% of the way there, 65% of the way there. So my advice is, if you truly love this stuff, don't be like a victim of clickbait and look at these 10-second clips and think you know the issue, and then, you know, point your finger and say, oh, it's all that guy's fault. That's my advice. So, Blaine, what would your advice be to close this one out? Because we're pulling on an hour. What would your advice be to the listeners when you're looking at all these issues about redfish and menhaden?
We got to look at ourselves in the mirror. I mean, collectively, it's everybody always wants to point fingers at one thing or the other, but it's all of us as a whole. Things are overfished, whether it's the menhaden fleet with their bycatch of redfish or whatever it may be, or killing all the bait. The recreational anglers are as much at fault because, it, you know, for some people, it's all about dock shots. Nothing ever goes back. It doesn't matter if it's a redfish or a cobia or striped bass. Collectively, we got to look at, technology has gotten so unbelievably good that there's no place for fish to hide anymore. And we have to be more responsible that more than ever, because one, you have environmental changes, you have overfishing going on. And when you have this perfect storm that's coming together in every fishery I go to, you know, not that the world's ending, but none of them are better than that, what they were. But what our voice is being heard, and it is important, truly important. And it's frustrating when you put these posts out to try to get people to sign letters to have their voice heard, how few people actually step up and do it. So if you love fishing and you love the fisheries that you go on vacation to go do and fish with these guys here that are on this tonight and the ones we've had in the past, it's, if you truly love it, you can't pass the buck off to hope somebody else fights for them. We all have to do it together. And we all have to get together, whether you are a conventional angler or a fly angler, it doesn't matter. And stop blaming one person or the other for doing something right or wrong, because at the end, it's all our fault. And if we let this die, we have no one else to look at other than us.
Scotty,
yeah,
in my world, there's Socrates, Plato, and Scotty Davis. What advice would you give to all the listeners of this podcast when they're looking at any advocacy issue?
This is kind of the same thing. I think we're plagued by too many 10-second smoke and mirrors kind of propaganda videos. I mean, the science is there. You know, we have all the info. Just dig deep for yourself and get as much info as you can and make your own decision. You know, it's everybody's fishery is different, yet they're all eerily connected. And when you see some group, there's 20 I've never heard of popping up just on this Menhaden thing, you know, and I don't know if they're donating money or trying to get clout for what they're doing, but like you said, that's not the whole root of the issue. And a lot of these people are claiming it is just so they have a job and they can get, you know, if we fix the problem, then they have no job. So therefore they're going to keep pushing a kind of an artificial problem. So I would just say, get as much information as you can and educate yourself. I mean, it's there. The South Carolina DNR put out all these studies, and then all the news stations would post social media posts like, hey, redfish laws are changing July 1st yesterday. And these people are like, oh, like you said, we got no problem with redfish. It's the commercial fleet. We haven't had a commercial fleet here since the 80s. Like, you obviously don't know what you're talking about. So just do humanity a favor and do your own research and formulate your own opinion. Don't rely on what somebody else is telling you, because the science and the data is out there for you.
Bought off tree huggers, Scotty.
Yeah.
They're paid off by the commercials.
Deep state Bailey? PSYOPs.
It's all a PSYOP, man. Bailey, you got anything to throw at the listeners?
I mean, you know, a lot of what Scotty said, I think, rings really true for what I deal with you guys and on a level on nationally too. I mean, take some time to really learn about these issues, because there's never just one thing. It's never a simple, it's this guy's problem, it's these people's fault. If we fix this, it'll all get better. That is so just bad for the conversation. And a lot of times the one that they're pointing the finger at is the hardest thing to change. And that's pretty much consistently throughout all these issues. And just take a little bit of accountability as anglers, I think. I think it's time to just really speak frankly to the recreational angling community and just be like, look, there's more of us than there's ever been. We've gotten better at fishing. The bar is raised because of technology and all these things. I mean, you start seeing more and more of these conversations about what LiveScope is doing to fishing. It's actually really interesting, because that all this stuff has made, we catch a lot more fish and there's more of us doing it. The sport has grown and grown and grown. And let's just start taking a little bit of accountability for the impact we have on the resource. I think it's time to just own that. It's okay. We can all still make a living and feed our families off doing this as guides and travel companies and et cetera, et cetera. And let's really get behind taking care of it for the long term, so we all can keep doing this for another 20, 30, 40 years.
Ty, you get to close out in the Dear Abby advice column.
Well, I mean, you know me, I hate to be doom and gloom with it, and I hope that's not what people think this was, because it's definitely not doom and gloom. As Blaine said, you know, there's still things to look up to. We still have some incredible fishing down here, but I always point back to what it should be, and that's kind of what we wanted to do with this. It's like, we got to stop moving the goalposts. The shift to baseline theory stuff is real. And if people get accustomed to thinking, you know, that catching 8 fish in 30 minutes on live shrimp under a cork is better than it was 15 years ago when every Joe Blow on a Saturday caught 100 a day, then, you know, we're just, you could just keep pointing the finger, or you could sit back, just like we talked about, look at yourself, acknowledge that we do have a pretty significant, if not the most detrimental effect to all of Mother Nature and our fisheries here, then I think the world would be a better place. And hopefully when you do type your stuff into AI, you know, like Tony said, it's pretty easy to do your research, look over all that stuff, look at the not just what Tony said about just typing in AI, let it do your research like that. Look at the people behind the things you're supporting. Look up those exact people. Look up their names. You know, are they fishermen? What are they posting about? Do they care? You know, don't just look at the company. Don't just look up how many followers.
Are they posting other people's photos?
Exactly. You know, are they just typing prompts into AI and AI is posting their other photos?
Steal people's photos on this podcast.
Are they raffling all four?
I mean, it's crazy, you know.
And Rolex watches.
No, I mean, it just really, though, I mean, I think that's a pretty, that should be a standard thing, you know? I mean, you wouldn't just go on Facebook and be like, this lady has 20,000 followers, let's let her watch the kids on Friday night, you know? You probably want to talk to that person, do a little research, and be like,
Scotty,
are they a family person?
Did that last week.
Yes. I mean, that's a good way to get invited to the White House for a fishery bill.
Boy, that was something else.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty, I don't know, I look at it and I look at all these people here and all these people that are kind of in those rooms saying the same thing as us, and I look at them like they actually care. Just find people who actually care about this fishery and those people, and ask those people a question, damn it. I mean, geez, so easy to get in touch with somebody. I guarantee you, anybody on this call right here, if you genuinely wanted to know, hey, man, I'm kind of watching what this person posted, but what y'all are saying kind of differs a bit. Can you explain it to me? I mean, that's easy. You know, that's a done deal.
You know, Ty, that's the rule. That's the social media rule that Cody reins me in with. If somebody asks a genuine question, we are polite and kind, and we will talk to them till the cows come home on social media. They can send us a direct message, whatever. We'll tell them what they know, what we know. And just like Scotty said, make up your own mind. But if you're nasty about it, you get the thunder. Y'all have seen the screenshots, right?
That's why we let Cody answer, not you.
No, every once in a while, Cody's like, to hell with it, let Tony answer. I'll send you some of the screenshots. In all reality, is like, you don't have to agree with us. I mean, that's fine. But if you don't want to sound like a fool, do some research. Because there are people who really know about this. And if you go around looking at those 10-second video clips and you start preaching about them, you really don't know as much as the people who know a lot. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe it's just that fly fishing mentality or whatever. But if I really care about something, I got to know everything about it. I got to dig in, look at every angle, every side of it. Because I want to be informed, and that's what we're asking y'all to do. So, you know, you heard the striper thing the other day. This is the redfish thing. And our message is simple. You know, both of these fisheries are struggling on multiple coasts, and there's still time to fix them if we start doing the right thing. And on another, you know, another chapter in the book is menhaden and other forage species, you know, river herring, all sorts of stuff in the Northeast. That's got to be fixed too. But that's a different fight. You got to be involved in multiple fights. You can't just point your finger and say it's their fault. That'll cure everything, because it's not going to. So I want to thank Ty, Scotty, Bailey, Blaine, for sharing, you know, your love, knowledge, and passion of the sport. I'm sure the listeners got a lot out of it, and I can't wait to have y'all on here again. So thank you very much for your time, gentlemen. We hope everybody enjoyed it.